In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened.
We are a nation generated by ideas, the beneficiaries of people who took terrific risks and who were a fount, if you will, of originality and ingenuity.
So if people have views that you find offensive, we can either silence them so that nobody challenges us for 4 years, or we can welcome them, debate with them, and try to hash it out and make us all smarter.
So continuing with our Great Leader series, we started off last time with Alfred the Great. We gave him our perfect score. And this week we come to Salah ad-Din, also known as Saladin, the leader of the Islamic side during the Third Crusade. With me, of course, is Jason. Jason, before we get into talking about Saladin more in depth, what do you think about the historical background of the Crusades in general? I think we need to talk about those if we're going to talk about the socio-political context in which Saladin is operating and why we like him so much.
Yeah, I think that I completely agree with you when you say that it is impossible to talk about Saladin without mentioning the Crusades, the same way that we could not have talked about Alfred without mentioning the Danish invasions. Except that there are way more hot takes about the Crusades than there are about the Danish invasions. So for those listeners who are not familiar with the Crusades more than just picturing knights swinging their swords out in the desert, the Crusades were a series of Christian holy wars smack dab in the middle of the Middle Ages, and the original intent of the Crusades was to stop the rapidly growing Muslim power in the Middle East. They had been disrupting trade. There had been threats against some of the eastern bulwarks of Christianity, like the remnants of the Byzantine Empire or some of the Christian kingdoms in what is now modern-day Bulgaria. There were even Muslim raiders and pirates that were making their way up and down the Italian coastline. One of the things that caused Pope Urban to go, all right, it's time for a crusade, is that a shipment of goods and services to the Vatican was taken over by the Muslims. So from a purely geopolitical perspective, I don't have a problem with the Crusades. The Muslims were indeed a massive threat to the Christian kingdoms. I also don't think it hurts that this also would have stopped the Christian kingdoms from fighting one another to focus their energy on an external force. The issue that I have with the Crusades, and it's quite a big issue, is that they did almost everything wrong that they possibly could have. They're going down there to break Islamic power, and they do so. The first Crusades are very successful. But after they break that Islamic power, they decide to set up their own Christian kingdoms smack dab in the middle of Islamic territory, the Kingdom of Jerusalem being the biggest example. While I can see from a purely religious point of view why you would want to have the Kingdom of Jerusalem be a thing, have the Christians be able to worship God in peace in the holiest city, strategically it makes absolutely no sense, because you are placing a very vulnerable kingdom smack dab in the middle of enemy territory. You are not frequently supplying it, and because the British and the French and the Germans and the Spaniards and the Italian warlords as well, they're all squabbling over who gets what authority, they essentially don't have any peace treaties with the Kingdom of Jerusalem. They pretty much look at this very new kingdom with 95% of its population being Muslim citizens that hate it, wave goodbye and say, you're on your own now. Best of luck. Except who's going to be king of this new kingdom? Nobody wants that job. Well, nobody spectacular wants that job because it's going to be thankless. So you get the C-listers and the D-listers of Europe who become the king and the nobles and the lords and the ladies of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So already we're off to a very bad start. And then something that you had just mentioned right before we started recording today, if there is one thing that the Christians in the Middle Ages hated more than Muslims, it would be other Christians. So there were several crusades that, even though their target was the Holy Land, they ended up attacking more Christian forces than they did Muslim forces. So I am fine with the theory of the crusades, but the way they went about doing it and the barbarity that they treated their people, their newly conquered people with, it's inexcusable. There's really no defense for it other than saying, no, the Muslims were a threat. I understand why you did it, but awful, awful. It was recently disproven, but for a while, there were some studies wondering, did the Crusades actually kill more people than World War II? And the answer is no. More people died in World War II than they did in the Crusades. But it was closer than I think anyone would be comfortable with. It was a closely run thing.
I mean, I'll just say I don't like the Crusades. I think that while, yes, it is true, there was a lot of imperialism going on in the Middle East by the Islamic forces. Even Saladin himself took some part in this, though we'll talk about that later. I don't see that as an excuse for Western imperialism at all. And I think that absolutely the idea that, oh, because we are all quote-unquote Christian, even though we've been murdering each other over theological and ethnic differences disguised as theological differences for centuries, we get to go conquer where somebody else lives and pretend that it's always been ours and that we have this divine right to it. I have very little regard and very little time for the argument that the Crusades are at all justified in the sense of an offensive war to go conquer Jerusalem. If you want to say that, sure, they had the right to defend against the expansion of the Islamic empires, sure, yeah, there were pirates that were attacking Italy, like you said, that's fine. But if you want to try to seriously make the case to me that there is any way, shape, or form that they have the right to go and rule Jerusalem, I just don't see how that works. I mean, yeah, maybe you could argue that, you know, there was preying on pilgrims, and that is true. There was preying on Christian pilgrims. But I don't see that as necessarily being worth a full war. And certainly it's not worth a war where you go and you take over Jerusalem and then, you know, you kick out all the Jews and you, at least initially until you realize what a bad idea it is, try to restrict the worship of Muslims. It's just might makes right rhetoric, and I have very little time for it and very little respect for that idea. Now, that being said, yes, I think that the horror of the Crusades, well, I mean, you're right, a lot of people died, like you said, almost as many as World War II. The Crusaders were scuzzballs, but a lot of people act as if they were the ultimate evil, as if they were something out of a horror movie, and I think that that's really unfair to do.
The Crusaders were not Nazis, and it's disingenuous to both the Crusaders and to the Nazis to make that comparison, because it diminishes what the Jewish people suffered under the Holocaust, and it diminishes the evilness of the Nazis.
That's something that is really interesting just in the modern 20th century, especially 21st century American ethos, right? As our only gauge for horror is the Nazis, and so we have to try to like jump straight to there, where it's like, well, no, if you read any history about what a conquering army does, the Crusaders were pretty standard, because conquering armies generally do things like this. War crimes are basically a foregone conclusion. It's why war shouldn't be something that we treat casually, jump into, what have you. But that being said, since we've covered a little bit of the history of the Crusades and our thoughts on them, and we've gotten that out of the way, the Third Crusade is where Saladin comes into play. He is a Kurdish leader of what would later be called the Ayyubid dynasty or the Ayyubid kingdom. He was the Sultan of Egypt. He led he was the leader of the Islamic forces against the Crusaders themselves. And he ends up ending the kingdom of Jerusalem that you talked about and recapturing Jerusalem itself. He has a long ongoing war with Richard the Lionhearted, where they actually both have a lot of mutual respect for each other. He actually spends a great deal of his time before the Crusades fighting wars and making peace within the Islamic world itself. We mentioned this a little bit last time. The video game Assassin's Creed, the original one, actually is based off of the Third Crusade and Saladin's in it. And historically, he did actually interact with the Assassins, the Hashishin Order. He unified the Islamic world behind him. He was able to take the Kingdom of Jerusalem, had an ongoing feud, the one that was marked by respect, with Richard and the Crusaders, and then he died shortly after the end of the Third Crusade itself. In fact, I don't believe the Crusaders had even really left their bases in the Middle East by the time Saladin died. So we're going to be using, to evaluate Saladin, we're going to be using the same system that Jason used last time. So rather than go linearly through his story, we'll talk about different elements of his story and who he was as a person under these different headings. And then we'll finish off by talking about his legacy and what do we want to live under him and what can we learn from him today. So starting with character, I gave him a 4 out of 5 for his character. He showed a lot of mercy, and he was very atypical for the way he used mercy. Now, there was sometimes when he was merciful that this was a practical concern, and you can easily make the case, well, yes, but that was also the most convenient decision for him to make. And I'm like, yes, this is true, but that wasn't necessarily something that his colleagues in the warlord industry really thought about. A lot of them thought more about making statements. So when he fought, for example, and I'm probably massacring the pronunciation, I have no background in Arabic, but the Zengiel dynasty, he actually freed their prisoners of war, he gave them gifts, he took no plunder for himself. Even with the crusade itself, what ended up sparking the Third Crusade, he only started fighting the Crusaders when they violated the treaties they'd had with the Islamic powers by waltzing into Damascus. They basically felt they had a right to the entire Holy Land, which, I mean, that is literally what they thought. And so they left the Kingdom of Jerusalem, they kept breaking treaty by going to Damascus, and that's what sparked Saladin to start the crusade. He wasn't particularly bloodthirsty as a man. That being said, he was a warlord, which is why I only gave him a 4 out of 5. He did do some things where, for example, he sold a lot of the Frankish settlers into slavery after retaking Jerusalem. There were some slaughters that he oversaw. But I would genuinely think that, especially for his time, and the way he personally dealt with difficulties, with hardships, and with his task. I mean, his job was to lead the Islamic side in the Crusades. I think he did it very well, and there's a lot we could learn from him and admire in him. There's a couple of anecdotes that I think really exemplify this. So first off, Richard the Lionheart, who is famous from the Robin Hood story, was actually kind of personally... I think I'd give him a 2 for character if we were reviewing Richard the Lionheart. He was not a particularly nice guy, but he really respected Saladin. And when Richard was very sick, Saladin actually sent over his own doctor under a flag of truce to treat Richard because he felt it was important that he comport himself as a king would, and kings were supposed to show mercy in Saladin's perspective. He also was actually friends with a number of Christian leaders, including several of the Eastern Christians. This was before the sack of Constantinople, mind, but even before that, they did not get on super well with the Western Christians. A lot of them trusted Saladin to be a better leader than they trusted the Western Christians to be. And he was known for being a fair judge. He was known for his generosity as well, to the point that when he died essentially in poverty. He did not have really any fortune at all, because he had made sure that his troops were paid. He made sure that he used his wealth for the benefit of others. So I give him a 4 out of 5. Warlord stuff prohibits me giving him a full 5 out of 5, but I still think he did a really good job.
I also gave him a 4 for my rankings, because I do think that there was a lot about Saladin's character that was excellent. He wasn't like Alfred, who is just genuinely a good, virtuous person and therefore led a virtuous life, because that is what the situation demanded. He was more virtuous because, practically speaking, this was the most convenient way to get what he wanted, is what I would say about Saladin. One of the things that he did probably better than any other ruler of his time period is that he knew when and where violence was necessary. It wasn't his first option. He was more than willing to be peaceful and negotiate if it led him to a better outcome, I would say. Saladin was not the only leader among Muslim forces in the area. he was originally the Sultan of Egypt, like you had mentioned, but there was a Sultan of Syria shortly before that Sultan's death, whose name was Nur ad-Din. And Saladin had a claim on Syria, and many people were encouraging him to go and attack Nur, who used to be his old mentor. He knew much about him. He knew that he was an old and ailing man. But Saladin said, attacking right now only makes us weak in the face of these Christian kingdoms. I am going to bide my time, even though it may not be the best thing for me. And I'm going to wait until Nur's death, and then I shall take over it. And he did. He was able to take over the kingdoms after that. He was much, as you had mentioned, much less bloodthirsty than many of the other warlords of that time. Many of those other medieval kings where your bloodthirstiness was a sign of your manliness and your virility. And he didn't really subscribe to that whole deal. He was also known to be particularly kind and open-handed or generous with his defeated foes. And a part of this was because he truly did want to treat them well. He didn't believe in karma so much as in, if I treat these people well, odds are that they will in turn treat me well too. There is a famous tale that one of the Frankish women that Saladin had sold into slavery, her child was accidentally taken from her and was sold to someone else. And so Saladin had his guards personally track down that slaver, and Saladin personally bought that child from his master and gave it to the mother so that the two of them could be reunited. So there are several stories about that and some of the more merciful things, like you said. But I will say that unlike Alfred, who lived this virtuous life because that's what virtue demanded for him, Saladin is doing most of this not because he wants to be a good person, but because he thinks that being a good person will be the biggest advantage. So I have also given him a 4 out of 5 for slightly different reasons than you did.
There's almost something Machiavellian in that description, right? Like he was being a good person because he thought it would get him advantages. I'm not sure if that's true necessarily, just because there were plenty of times where he made a smart decision. But there would have been advantages to not being merciful. There would have been advantages to sending a message, and I think that his character is. I mean, I don't really know why I'm disagreeing with you, other than I disagree with you.
You're just a disagreeable person.
Okay, sometimes I like to disagree. Well, anyway, regardless, we don't actually disagree, so we'll leave it at 4. For composure, I give Saladin a 5 out of 5 for composure. Mm-hmm. Very easily. I mean, when we're talking about composure in this series, we're talking about basically cool-headedness under fire, right? We're talking about, you know, I believe the example you used was you wouldn't really give Calvin Coolidge a high score for composure because he never really had to deal with a struggle.
And I love Coolidge. I have been very vocal about my love for Coolidge on this program. So, yeah, you know that this is a really hard one to get a good score in.
Yeah, but I absolutely think Saladin deserves a 5 out of 5. By the time of the Third Crusade, especially, the Crusaders were really little more than terrorists. They felt that they were under the impression that they had the right to own Jerusalem, and they had the right to go to there whenever they wanted, and that this meant that they, by proxy, had the right to basically do whatever they wanted throughout the Middle East because God wills it. That was that was literally their war cry, Deus Vult. So you had these Crusaders routinely engaging in things like piracy. Actually, one of the first things that brought Saladin to prominence in international politics, quote unquote, was more like among the warlords than it would be, say, like him appearing on ye olde CNN. But he dealt with this with Crusader pirates who were attacking local villages. They were just sacking them and taking their stuff, taking them as slaves. And he's like, we need a navy and we need to go take care of these pirates. He actually got involved in the Third Crusade, or rather, he started it. His move on Jerusalem started it when he realized that he couldn't keep tolerating Crusader presence in his turf because they came after his shepherds and tribesmen. They basically thought, this is going to be easy. We can go after the Ayyubids and we can just march them. They're just shepherds. They're defenseless. And he waited until they were getting really close to the sheep, and then he led a cavalry charge and killed every single one of them. And was like, they're not going to stop being aggressive unless we kick them out and make them go back to Europe where they're supposed to be. So he routinely responds in calm, dignified ways. He didn't just say we're having a crusade immediately. He was pushed into starting the Third Crusade. He also did it in such a way that he was always dedicated to protecting his people and advancing his cause. He never lost his cool, and his goal was always to have a better outcome and end up in a better place than when he started. He wasn't one for, shall we say, total war or making stupid strategic decisions. He wanted to minimize war, and he wanted to ensure that it was fought in the right way and for the right reasons, which is why he was often so merciful, is that once an enemy was defeated, that was enough. But he wasn't so merciful that he didn't recognize that it was his job as a leader to protect his own people. So I gave him a 5 out of 5 for composure, simply because, I mean, I think he knew what he was doing, and by the end of it, he certainly knew what he was doing. He was fighting the largest powers of Europe, and he did so with aplomb, and he won, and that's quite impressive. I mean, it wasn't a grand sweeping victory necessarily, but because he kept a cool head and because he stayed true to his values and what he and his goals in fighting a war, he was able to win. So I gave him a full 5 out of 5 for composure.
I don't think that there is much more I can add on to that. I think that you did a very good job of summing up how both of us feel. I also gave him a 5 out of 5. The reason that this was so darn impressive is I mentioned earlier in this podcast that the best leaders in Christendom weren't here because there was nothing for them. The best killers in Christendom are here, though, because this is where the good money is at, is being a mercenary killer in the Middle East will earn you a lot of money. These holy orders like the Knights Templar that used to be just a bunch of armed knights guiding pilgrims towards the Holy Land have become contract killers for hire. And they're good at what they do. Their favorite target is killing Muslims, and they have become quite exceptional at it. And Saladin has a weakened dynasty, half of whom don't view him as their legitimate leader because their legitimate leader just passed away, and they feel that Saladin is a vulture coming to pick on its corpse. They look at him and go, "There is no way that you can lead us to victory over the Christians." And then after Saladin gets a couple of victories in, well, then the kings of Europe come down because they go, "Okay, playtime's over. Time for us to start protecting what's ours." And for him to have eked out that victory, for him to have kept his head and realized that the best way to win was to play the Christian leaders and their paranoia against one another, it's exceptional. And I don't think that just anyone could have done it. I think that you have to have a level of composure that not many people in human history have ever had. So kudos to Saladin for playing a great strategic game. You went into it briefly that it wasn't the cleanest of victories, and I think that I also have some stuff to say about that later on too, but that doesn't take away from his composure. Just the cojones on this guy to stare down all of Christendom and make them blink first. Pretty impressive.
As you say, with the organizations like the Knights Templar and them behaving the way that they did, it would have been very easy for him to decide that he was going to stoop to their level. And he did precisely the opposite. And I think that's important because that leads me into the next category, which is tolerance, where I also gave him a 5 out of 5. As I mentioned earlier, he was friends with numerous Christians. Tamar of Georgia was actually was the leader I was trying to think of. She was an Eastern Orthodox Christian queen, and she admired Saladin, and they were friends, and they got on well. Because Saladin protected the rights of his Christians and Jewish subjects in a way that the Crusaders didn't. Yes, the Knights Templars' favorite targets in the Middle East were Muslims, but their second favorite target in the Middle East was Jews, and their favorite target in Europe was Jews. This meant that Saladin had a lot of Jews who were willing to work for him and with him and even fight for him. His doctor was Jewish. He had both Christian and Jewish generals in his armies and soldiers in his armies because they were like, well, we're going to get a better shake from him than we are from anyone in the Crusader forces, so we'd rather fight with Saladin. Some other concrete examples I think that demonstrate his tolerance, especially for the time. Like, especially for the time, and especially in the light of what the Crusaders had been doing. When he captured Jerusalem, he offered very generous terms. He was like, I will give you plenty of time to get out. I am not going to sack the city. I'm not going to, you know, demand unconditional surrender. I'll let you, you know, I'll basically let you walk out with your lives. He forgave the ransom price for poor refugees. He did make, you know, nobles and stuff. They had to pay ransom prices to leave. That was just standard.
It's how you finance your army.
Yeah.
You finance your army by getting people to pay you ransom.
After a really tough campaign, you know, it would have been very easy for him upon taking Jerusalem, say, okay, and now heads will roll. In fact, during the war against the Crusaders at the Battle of Hattin, he faced, you know, the Jerusalem forces. He faced a bunch of Italian forces, and one of his particular opponents, Reynald of Châtillon, which I believe is how you pronounce it. I'm not good at French. He was one of those pirates I mentioned earlier. He'd been routinely attacking Muslim trading and pilgrimage routes. He had been threatening to attack Mecca and Medina, you know, the two holy cities of Islam. So basically doing what the Crusaders had claimed that the Muslims were doing. And, you know, if it's okay for the Crusaders, it's now okay for Saladin to do what he's doing. And there'd just been this long series of fights between them. And at the Battle of Hattin, Reynald was there, and Saladin had him executed because of the fact, not that Reynald had been fighting him. That wasn't why he had him executed at all. He didn't have him executed because they were rivals. He didn't even have him executed because of the threats. He had him executed because Reynald of Châtillon had violated treaties left, right, and center. In fact, during when he'd been engaging in this piracy, the Muslim traders and caravans had said, you know, hey, we have a truce with you. The Islamic forces and the Crusaders have these truces. You can't murder us. And Reynald basically said, yeah, I don't care. He blasphemed Muhammad, and then he murdered and tortured a bunch of them. And Saladin said, okay, I'm going to kill him, and I'm going to do it personally. When Reynald was captured, Guy of Lusignan, which again, Lusignan, not good at French. He was the king consort of Jerusalem. He was also captured, and when he saw Saladin have Reynald killed, he was really, really scared, and he basically said, you know, I guess I'm dying too. And Saladin just turned to him and goes, quote, it is not the habit of kings to murder kings. That man has transgressed all bounds of decency, and therefore did I treat him thus. There is naught to fear from me. So it wasn't like he didn't know how to use violence. It wasn't like he was just impotent or incapable. It was that he had a principal devotion and dedication to tolerance and decency, which kind of goes into my previous point. After capturing Jerusalem, he captured Jerusalem on a Saturday. The very next day, Sunday, he allowed churches to open. He did insist that mosques be higher than churches. That is part of Islamic culture, but he still let them worship freely and unmolestedly. And here's the thing that he did. This is why he really endears himself to me, and this is why I really have no tolerance for the idea of people saying, oh, the Crusaders were pretty good guys, and it's just modern political correctness that has made us think of them as bad people. The Crusaders hadn't held on to Jerusalem for more than about 5 minutes when they started kicking out as many Jews as they possibly could. They exiled all the Jews from Jerusalem, you know, our holy city too. When Saladin took back Jerusalem, he actually summoned all the Jews from around Israel and from the Middle East to Jerusalem. He's like, here, this is yours now. You can go back to the city. You can live here. You can go back to where your grandparents were kicked out of. You can live here as citizens with rights. I'm going to give you what the Crusaders wouldn't and didn't. And even at the end of the Crusades, or at the end of the Third Crusade, rather, with the truce with Richard the Lionhearted, Saladin allowed for unmolested travel to Jerusalem. Even though he was like, this day is under my control. We earned it. We took it by right of conquest. I'm still going to let Christians travel there. There will be no molesting of pilgrims. And again, this is why I don't think it's necessarily wrong for him to have had smart ideas behind this, because it was a smart idea to do this, because this really undermines the perceived legitimacy of the Crusades, pretty much period. The entire religious argument for them was, well, they're not letting us march to Jerusalem and we can't go to a pilgrimage.
They did not sell it as a way to prevent the Muslims from being a dangerous political force. It was, we have been kicked out of the holiest of holies, and so we must go back there.
Yeah, the entire rhetoric was religious, and so Saladin, by saying, yeah, you can totally go to Jerusalem, you can go there and pray, you can pray at the, you can pray at the Gethsemane tomb, I don't care. You just can't carry swords into my city, but you will not be molested. There, I will give you rule of law. That's smart. But it was also really not something he would have had to have done, and even though it was a smart decision, I think he still deserves applause for it, and that's why I give him a 5 out of a 5, because even though he got something out of it, most of his peers wouldn't have done it. Most of his peers weren't doing it. Certainly it wasn't what the Crusaders had done or would do, and I think it's really interesting that it's you know, I study honor culture, and certainly both Saladin and the people he were fighting exemplify a lot of the problems of an honor culture, like the constant cycle of revenge that comes up in an honor culture. You can't tolerate any disrespect. Disrespect must be met with violence. Strong men are violent and bloody men. And I think what Saladin does a really interesting thing of exemplifying, for me at least, is the positive sides of an honor culture, and that he knows that people will be reciprocal if you just extend a hand. He believes that that you should earn worth in the eyes of others, but it should be the right others. It shouldn't just be you want other people to fear you. It should be you want to be respected by noble people and demonstrate yourself to be noble as well. He still kept the, you know, he was still violent, but this was the Middle Ages. Pacifism is a virtue for people who can afford it. The Middle Ages were not such a time. So for me, I still think he deserves a 5 out of 5 for his tolerance. I think there are a lot of stories, I'm sure you have a couple as well, that demonstrate that he went above and beyond when it came to tolerance. And I think he was honestly, he's looking at when he ruled, he was probably the best example of a tolerant leader after Alfred the Great in history at this point in time. Like the most tolerant leader previous to him, I would say, was Alfred's allowing the Danelaw. Because certainly the medieval kings up to this point, their idea of tolerance is, well, maybe I'll let your youngest kids live when I sack your village.
I won't wipe out your entire bloodline. You're welcome.
Yes, aren't I generous? So he gets a 5 out of 5 for me.
I love everything you said there. I am going to give Saladin a 4 on tolerance, not for anything that you just mentioned. I think that post-Crusades, Saladin was an extremely tolerant individual. When he was just the Sultan of Egypt, he was very politically intolerant. Culturally, he had always been tolerant because he realized that there were just some battles that weren't worth putting out that much effort. But politically speaking, even after the Crusades, he was very, very intolerant. He did not want people with opposing views anywhere in his government. He did not allow other factions to form that might think different things than him. Not even that they were hostile. If you believed that things should be run a different way than what Saladin had envisioned, then you were going to have a very bad time. Exile or death were common in this instance. And these were also the people that if, say, there was a valuable hostage that he had from the Crusaders, and they were looking to do a hostage swap and any of his political enemies were there, Saladin just said, keep them. I don't mind. It's better off for me that they're no longer in my camp. So I'll give him a 4 just because of his political intolerance. But for the other stuff that you said, absolutely fantastic. I have no issue with any of that. And this is getting a little bit into, hey, what can we learn about these people today? I think Saladin is one of the very best examples in history of what you do to a defeated opponent after your victory. And something that I think the Democrats could learn from today is I think that if they copied a little bit more of Saladin, who, again, person of color, not your white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, so we would be allowed to mention him in the Democratic Party today, I think that they would do very well to treat Republicans how Saladin treated Christians. And I also think that if the Republicans win in 2022, although perish the thought that they would ever read anything anti-crusade, but if they win in 2022 and they have a bare victory because Biden would still be in the White House, they could also learn from Saladin about when you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them, as the song says. And Saladin was an expert at that.
I think what, and again, we'll come back to this because you're right. This is a little bit more of the what we can learn. But I think it's fine here because it fits under tolerance. I think what he exemplifies, Saladin does, is there's nothing to risk and there's nothing wrong with being the bigger person, because he was very well regarded in European courts. Richard the Lionheart spoke very highly of Saladin.
Oh, they all loved him.
They felt indeed. I can't remember the full quote exactly, and I can't decipher my chicken scratch handwriting, but I will paraphrase. The quote was that there's not among the knights of Christendom such a paragon of knightly virtue as Saladin himself, because he outstripped them, and he did. He was very generous in victory. So I think that kind of really, it put a stop to what could have otherwise kept going on. And I think that if it had been anyone else but Saladin, that the crusade would have ended very differently. So I think his tolerance is great. So for prosperity, and this is one where I think actually, I wonder if you would like to take the lead for the score of prosperity, because this deals with kind of his, what's going to happen after he doesn't leave office, he dies. there were not elections for caliphs.
I will save the part for after he dies for the legacy portion. But as far as the prosperity goes, I'm going to give him a 3. Because even though, hooray, the Muslims are back in control of the Holy Land, this isn't over by a long shot. The quality of life is still absolutely horrid for people in that portion of the world. You have got a bunch of different ethnicities and religions that absolutely hate one another. And congratulations, you're being tolerant to them. That doesn't mean that they are going to be tolerant to one another. Poverty is sky high, even for medieval times, because of all of the infrastructure damage that the Third Crusade wrought. The Europeans, even though they have been kicked out of the Holy Land, are looking at it and sort of licking their lips greedily, going, oh, this isn't over yet. It's not even close to being over. They're waiting for a Fourth Crusade. And I'll get more into that when we come to legacy about what happened during the Fourth Crusade. But it's not great in the Middle East. And while Saladin is a great uniter and a superb military commander, he doesn't quite have Alfred's ability to harness all of that creative intelligence into something that will last in peacetime. So it's a 3, because he did not do anything to make it worse, but he didn't do anything to make it better. So I would give him an average score of a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, I gave him the exact same score, and for very similar reasons. If we were just looking at his younger pre-Crusade career, I would probably give him a 4, because he establishes the Ayyubid dynasty, he does capture Jerusalem, and he does establish Muslim power in a lot of ways, but then the Crusade happens, and again, this is skirting the legacy issue, but the result of his actions to capture Jerusalem does mean that there is now an unstable situation, even in his own lifetime. There is an uneasy peace, and it is, as you mentioned, the Europeans are itching for another crusade. Even though the Crusaders hadn't won, they hadn't really lost to Saladin either. He hadn't, like, again, because he was merciful, he didn't, like, chase down the Knights Templar and kill them. That would be what the French did that to themselves.
Hey, it's because they were about $40 million in debt to the Knights Templar. But you know, if you accuse them of being Satanists, no church is going to frown on you for refusing to give a Satanist money. So clearly the Knights Templar are devil worshippers.
Yep.
It makes sense when you don't think about it, Aaron.
I mean, that was a classic French tactic that numerous French kings would use again and again. It's like, I am massively in debt. I will say that they worship Satan.
It's genius.
I can read egg on my desk. Have we looked into this to deal with the American deficit? That's what I want to know. Have we considered saying Satan is involved in this somehow? And we can go back on this, on the, what are we at, 22 trillion?
Ever since Woodrow Wilson, Beelzebub has been living inside the desk in the Oval Office.
You can't prove it's not true. So for the last category, sorry, the penultimate category, we have protection. And by protection, we mean protection of rights, protection of liberty. Here is where I'm going to bow to your standards here, because if I were being totally subjective, I'd give him a 5. If I were just saying, nope, I'm just going to look at him in his context and for his time, I would say I'd give him a 5. I can't think of another person I'd want to live under beyond him. Certainly as a Jewish person, I'd be like, yeah, no, beats England. In fact, again, England had actually kicked all their Jews out, or would go on to kick all their Jews out relatively soon after this.
And France is accusing you of devil worship right now, so yes. Can't go there.
Yes, there's nowhere for me, but I can go and live in Jerusalem under the Ayyubid Caliphate and be relatively okay. That being said, like, did he respect rights in any way that we would probably think of today? No. So I am still being a little bit subjective in giving him that 4. I think if you talk to him ideas about life, liberty, and property, or the life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, or human dignity or something, he'd give you a very quizzical look. But I would say that for his time, he was a paragon of tolerance, and because of that tolerance, that led to him protecting a lot of people's rights. So I give him a 4 out of 5. I don't give him a full 5 out of 5 because he did still allow for the enslavement of the Frankish Christians from the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He allowed a lot of them to purchase their way out of slavery. It wasn't like this was something atypical for the time. In fact, it was very typical for the time. The Crusaders were also slavers. But it's just because it was typical for the time doesn't mean I'm going to excuse it. And because of that, I'm going to give him a 4 out of 5.
I'm glad that you bring up the slavery thing and how complicated that is. I was waiting until we were here to talk about this. But the issue with how we view slavery today, especially in the United States of America, is it is that Black African-American slavery for life plantation system, where you were born with a collar on, you shall die with a collar on, and the same shall be for your children. It's not that way in the Middle Ages. It won't be that way until slavery gets really commercialized, starting in the 1400s. Many people in the medieval ages, and this goes all the way back to ancient Greece, and in some cases even in Egypt, many people would sell themselves into slavery to pay off a debt. And a lot of times that's what happened with Saladin's forces, is there was something, the Anglo-Saxons had a word for it called the wereguild, where if you killed someone, and we're not talking about murder, but say it's accidental manslaughter, it was on the battlefield and you killed someone, that family is entitled to charge you financial restitution for what happened, because that person was worth X amount of gold or silver. Well, Saladin is saying, okay, many of you are held hostage, and it's all legalese speak, but he does have reasons for this. Many of you are held hostage right now because you now live on land that rightfully belongs to my caliphate. You need to pay me this price. Well, I am a poor peasant living in Judea, so I can't pay my wereguild. Okay, sell yourself into slavery, and that debt will be considered appropriate. Your children will not be slaves after this, and your slavery may only last for a period of 30 years. It is a different sort of slavery that we're talking about there. And when you go and talk about objective stuff, I'm glad that you at least mentioned why I'm giving him a 5 and not a 4. Something that I always tell my children to be, that makes it sound like they're my biological kids, something that I tell my students to be aware of all the time is that if you use modern values to judge these people from history, you will not learn as much. No, I'm not saying that you have to approve of what they did. By all means, feel free to look at their mistakes and go, ah, this is how I will improve off of what they did, but you will never be able to learn from their successes if you cannot get past the fact that they do not act the way that you would expect people today to act. And so his tolerance was revolutionary for the time. The things that he encouraged were revolutionary for the time. And so therefore, I don't think that there is anything else that I can give him besides a 5, because this tolerance that he has will pave the way for centuries for the Arab world to be the leader in technology, in philosophy, and a bunch of other things because they accepted that tolerance. He also did one heck of a job protecting people's natural rights of life, liberty, and property for the Arab people down there, because the Christian leaders were abusing them left and right. And so the Muslims and the Jews were being persecuted. And to be honest, the Christians didn't even have it all that well. For some Christians, life under Saladin improved. And so instead of protecting one out of three groups of people's natural rights, Saladin is protecting, I'd say, 2.5. So he definitely gets that 5 from me.
So what I'm hearing is that I can't believe I did a 4 out of 5 because I was trying not to be like, I was trying to be so objective and like, no, certain things are wrong. And you do me dirty like that. I think you have valid points about slavery being different back then. I don't agree with slavery, even that type of slavery. I still think it's wrong and immoral and awful. That being said, obviously it wasn't as bad as chattel slavery, but then again, serfdom wasn't as bad as chattel slavery. I still don't like serfdom. I think you do raise a really good point about not just judging him according to modern standards, and I do think that's worth talking about. But yeah, I'm gonna remain resolute with the 4. I was gonna see if you could change my mind, but no, I'm staying resolute with my 4. Final category though is legacy, and I know we both have things to say here. You know, what did he leave behind? What is his? How was the world in his absence? How did he change things? Was it for the good? Was it for the bad? So what are you thinking about? What do you think of him in that category? How did you score him? What do you think?
This is complicated, and I feel bad at myself for scoring him the way that I do. I give him a 3. And this is something, this is probably sacrilegious, and for any Muslim viewers, I apologize if this is deeply offensive. Saladin's death reminds me quite a bit of Muhammad's, where this brilliant strategic mastermind dies, but there is no clear plan of succession after he is gone. And so people start to squabble, people start to fight. And while the dynasty continues, there is so much infighting that it allows for Saladin's legacy to be fractured by a bunch of different people who claim that he meant certain things to the region, and it also allows for a lot of military and political instability in the region after Saladin dies, because he does not have a clear succession plan, unlike our boy Alfred, who made it to where kings of England were able to prosper for centuries after he was gone because of the groundwork he laid. Saladin, boy, I sort of feel this way about Teddy Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson. If they had never been presidents, they would have been some of my favorite Americans of all time. And if Saladin had died a glorious martyr's death at the very end of his crusader campaigns, I would have been looking at him and going, oh, how fantastic of a person was he. But things were very unstable after the Crusades were over. And because Saladin was unable to corral the people of the Middle East together afterwards, they were very vulnerable for the Fourth Crusade that was coming down the line. The only reason they were saved is because, like I said earlier, the only thing that Christians hated more than Muslims was other Christians. And so they sacked the city of Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire at the time. And so those crusaders sort of got distracted and waylaid, and the crusade fizzled out before it reached the Middle East. But if it had reached the Middle East, there's a good chance that they would have retaken Jerusalem. So he didn't do all that well in the end. And I also think that another part about his legacy is that even though for a long time Alfred's legacy was sort of pushed to the side for other things, he was always held in very high honor. There are many people in the Middle East who have never heard of Saladin before because he doesn't stand for what they currently wish for this place to be like. When you see all of these radical Islamic groups talking about how they want to have a Arabic caliphate once again, you don't see any group taking the Saladin approach instead of the radical Islamic approach, where he's unifying them through politics, not through religion, and being multicultural and religiously tolerant and all of this stuff. You don't see any of that. So I would have to give his legacy a 3, because he personally is fantastic. We can learn a lot from him, especially how to handle our defeated foes. But he did not leave a good situation behind in the Middle East after he left.
No, and I give him a 3 for the same reason. I think he had some positive things about his legacy. Like, he is very well known in the Middle East today. I don't think he's particularly well known outside of people who like Crusader history or who play Assassin's Creed. But even there, like, his legacy was kind of, has been occasionally, I should say, co-opted, depending on who wants to say what about who. But for me, the really big thing is, yeah, it's the fact that he left Jerusalem in a bad situation. The fact that the Fourth Crusade didn't make it to, I mean, we don't know, it's a counterfactual. For all we know, maybe they'd have pulled it together and they'd have held off the Crusaders.
It didn't look good.
I think
that we can objectively say that the odds of them doing so were not fantastic.
So from both of us, I mean, we switched around a couple of the numbers, but his final score from both of us is, I believe, a 24 out of 30. And that's a perfectly respectable score. There will be great leaders I think we're going to talk about that do not get that high of a score from me, but I still think are worth talking about.
My personal vote for next week is one that is lower than this. Well, I won't spoil it yet, but yeah, it's lower.
It's a respectable score. The last thing I want to talk about, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I think it's worth bringing up at least in brief, and that is, what can we learn from Saladin today? What can we take from his legacy? And I think this is really important, especially as people on the right, you know, they keep talking about wanting to build a more diverse Republican Party. And while people can laugh about that, I think it's a noble goal for people on the right to want.
If they don't do it, they will die.
Yes. And it has to be truly diverse, not, oh, well, we found, you know, we have Candace Owens, so we're racially progressive or something like that.
And while I have nothing personally against Candace Owens, there is an element of tokenism there that needs to be addressed.
I mean, I do, but that's because I don't like her views on criminal justice at all. Regardless, one of the big issues with diversity, I mean, not getting too much into it, but, you know, they're dealing with Marjorie Taylor Greene and her, you know, the Jews have a space laser thing.
I'm still shocked to find out that you don't, by the way. I
must have missed the meeting where we didn't have it. I just want it for 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
I want it for 5 minutes, dang it. One of the other things they need to evaluate besides that, you know, they're wondering why don't Jews vote Republican? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. You tolerate crap like this. And I think Muslim Americans would form another natural voting block for the Republican Party in a sense.
Religiously devout, hardworking, family-oriented. Honestly, besides the religion, it's like they were built in a lab for Republican voting.
Yes, but Republicans seem completely and utterly unable to get past a view of Islam that I think is backwards, built on stereotypes, and wrong. And they constantly talk about Judeo-Christian values, quote-unquote, as if there isn't already a huge gap between Jewish and the Christian faith. And as if there isn't a long history of Christians just murdering Jews for sport. And if they can talk about Judeo-Christian, I think it is perfectly acceptable to talk about, shall we say, Abrahamic values, and to encompass all three major faiths from that tradition. Honestly, I think Richard the Lionheart, a man I do not like, Robin Hood lied to you. He was not a good person. But if he can recognize this common ground with Saladin, I think we can do a dang sight harder. I think we can work harder at seeing that common ground that we have with Muslims today. You know, there's one of President Trump's campaign promises, his explicit campaign promises, was that he was going to start bugging mosques and kicking Muslims out. Like, he said that. And that's appalling, and thank God he never did it. But Islamophobia is real, and anti-Islamic sentiment is very real. And I think the legacy of Saladin, what he has to teach us today, is like, shockingly, Muslims are not really that different from you and I. I think he also has something to teach us about how cultural homogeneity isn't always necessary in the sense of tolerance. And this is something, you know, we've been screwing up for the last 20 years since 9/11, arguably longer, and how we depict Muslims and how we depict Islamic countries that we're fighting. We have to demonize them. And then we talk about, you know, like you have rhetoric like Ted Cruz's turn the sand into glass and stuff like that, as if that's acceptable rhetoric. And I think we could stand to look at somebody like Saladin, who, even though he was the Muslim and the Crusaders were the white Christians, he was dealing with terrorist attacks, essentially. And while he fought a war and he defended himself, and I'm not advocating for pacifism here, I think we can learn something from his example about what you do once you win, how you win, and not having to turn this into into race baiting. And perhaps that's me reading 21st century values back into a 13th century figure.
At least how I have pictured this series, because I hope this does become a series. I'm having fun, and I hope that people are enjoying it. My mother sent me a text about how much she enjoyed the Alfred episode. So, hi, Mom. I love you. I don't want us to just do great leaders and, oh, yes, look at this inspirational thing. We'll find great leaders. We will also be discussing people that we have a lot to learn from, good or bad.
All right. Well, this has been Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness. We'll be back. Take care, guys. This has been Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a share on social media or leaving us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at facebook.com/libertysnark or send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening.